I really don't know what I'm going to say in this sermon now. The choir just said it all in that wonderful anthem. It's 39 years ago now that I finally decided that I wanted to be, for me, a Unitarian minister. It was something that I had been toying with for many years, but happily had always managed to find an excuse not to do it. But in 1976, I spent the year doing what seems an almost an obligatory rite of passage for young Australians. I traveled the world. First to New Zealand, then the Pacific Islands, then North America, finally to Europe. So I had lots of time to think about life in general and my own life in particular, and I knew that as much as I'd loved my previous 4 years of jackarooing in the outback of Australia, I was probably not going to spend the rest of my life doing unspeakable things to other people's sheep. And especially during my travels around North America, whenever a Sunday came around, I would look for a church, a UU church if possible, if not, the friendliest looking one in town. And I had two motives for doing that. The first was that I really was kind of trying to sort out the meaning of my life, and a church is always a good place to do that. And the second was that I had discovered that it was almost a guaranteed way to get an invitation to lunch after the service. Anyway, I remember very clearly it was in Montreal on a Monday morning in October 1976 that I finally surrendered and decided, yes, I do want to be a minister. There was no loud voice from the sky, no road to Damascus experience. It really was a surrender to the inevitable, an itch that finally had to be scratched. I once heard that becoming a minister is a bit like throwing up. You can try to ignore it, you can put it off for a while, but sooner or later, if you really have to do it, then you just have to do it. That's how it was for me. And when I arrived in the UK, I made contact with the British Unitarians, who checked that I had a pulse. And before I knew it, I was a student at Oxford studying for the ministry, and my fate was sealed. I tell this tale to illustrate that although I was raised in a Unitarian congregation, and it was a wonderful part of my childhood, it's always been a central part of my self-identity, I've been a professional Unitarian Universalist, as it were, for almost four decades. I've spent the bulk of my career in the religion business. It would be reasonable for you to conclude, therefore, that I am pro-religion. You would be right. I think religion is not only a good thing, the impulse to be religious seems an essential part of who we are as human beings. I know it has been a good thing in my life. I see it being a good thing in other people's lives. I believe that the world would be a better place if more people were living genuinely religious lives, a la those words of Jean-Baptiste Molière. And yet, there are times when I am deeply embarrassed and ashamed by religion. There are times when I want to disown having anything to do with religion. When I see some of the abuses, some of the distortions, some of the violence, the hate done in the name of religion, then I recoil. The history of religion is not always pretty, and religion has been getting a particularly bad press of late. There are those, the militant atheists in the foreground, who look at the often ugly history of religion and who therefore denounce all religion as, at best, the fanciful nonsense of the simple-minded, or at worst, the deliberate instrument of human wickedness. But to denounce all religion because of its acknowledged and regrettable abuses, I suggest, is misguided and misinformed for at least two reasons. First, religion might be a handy hook on which to hang things, but usually it's not the real cause of its perceived transgressions. The conflict in Northern Ireland, for example, was certainly between Protestants and Catholics. But let me assure you, they were not fighting each other because of their disagreements over the doctrine of transubstantiation at the Eucharist. That was a conflict based on centuries of economic, political, and social oppression. The war in Bosnia in the early 1990s pitted Christians against Muslims, the Christians the brutal aggressors, let us remind ourselves. But that war was essentially about political tribalism. And the second reason is that the history of non-religion is not much better. Science continues to invent weapons of terrible destruction. Do we condemn all science? How many millions were slaughtered under Stalin's militantly atheist regime of terror? Was Maoist China a beacon of civilized enlightenment? Do we, because of those horrors, condemn all government? A little while ago, I saw the excellent movie Spotlight. I'm sure many of you did as well, which tells the story of the Catholic Church's cover-up of the sexual abuses of its priests in Boston. It's a telling indictment, to be sure. But the world of corporate capitalism has frequently been guilty of its own egregious cover-ups. To condemn all religion because of its excesses makes no more sense than to condemn all government, all science, or all business because of their excesses. And the demagogues of this land, so unattractively to the fore during this pre-presidential season, are falling over themselves and each other in their invective against Islam, demonizing it as a religion of hate and violence, totally oblivious to the bitter irony that their invective, spewed in the full ugliness of their Christian self-righteousness, is every bit as hateful and violent as the very thing they are condemning. You would think they might be just a tad shy of displaying their total ignorance of Islam so publicly. Just this last Friday, I was at prayers in the Salam Islamic Center in Sacramento. Can there be a more reverential people than Muslims? Islam is not in itself a hateful or violent religion, though some hateful and violent things are done by a few in its name. Christianity is not in itself a hateful or violent religion, though some violent and hateful things are done by a few in its name. Buddhism is not a hateful or violent religion, though some hateful and violent things are done by a few in its name. It seems to me that there are profound differences between what we shall call good religion and bad religion. Differences which are more universalizable, a word I just invented, you are free to use it, more universalizable than the unreflective bigotry of a simplistic, my religion good, your religion bad. It's too easy to make artificial distinctions based on nothing more than one's own particular allegiances and to demonize anyone who marches to the beat of a drum different from our own. I was walking across a bridge one day and I saw a man standing on the edge about to jump. So I rushed over to him and I said, "Stop, don't do it." And he said, "Well, why shouldn't I?" And I said, "Well, there's so much to live for." "Yeah, like what?" he said. "Well," I said, "are you religious?" And he said, "Yes." And I said, "Well, me too. Are you Christian or Buddhist?" And he said, "I'm Christian." And I said, "Well, me too. Are you Protestant or Catholic?" And he said, "Well, I'm Protestant." "Well, so am I. Are you Episcopalian or Baptist?" And he said, "Baptist." And I said, "Well, that's amazing. I am as well. Are you Baptist Church of God or Baptist Church of the Lord?" And he said, "Baptist Church of God." And I said, "That truly is extraordinary. So am I. Are you Original Baptist Church of God or are you Reformed Baptist Church of God?" And he said, "I'm Reformed Baptist Church of God." And I said, "I don't believe it. So am I. Are you Reformed Baptist Church of God, Reformation of 1879? Or Reformed Baptist Church of God, Reformation of 1915? And he said, "Reformed Baptist Church of God, Reformation of 1915. And I said, "Die, heretic scum," and I pushed him off. It's certainly true that the story of the Christian church, particularly from the Reformation on, has been a story of division and schism, often over the most trivial of theological, liturgical, ecclesiological, or interpersonal disagreements. Have you ever marveled that all except one denomination are named either after their founder, Luther, Swedenborg, Calvin, or because of a form of church governance, Episcopalian, Congregational, Presbyterian, or because of a style or feature of their worship, Baptist, Methodist, Quaker? There's only one denomination with a theological name, and that's us, Unitarian Universalist, and we're the only denomination not gathered around a common theology. But I want to suggest to you this morning that there are some identifiable characteristics which differentiate good religion from bad religion. Those characteristics have nothing at all to do with which religious tradition they identify. They're not about being Christian or not, being Muslim or not, being humanist or not. They transcend all such artificial demarcations. And I offer you five characteristics. I'm happy to pause for a few moments if you want to get out a pen and a piece of paper so that you can write these five down. The list is not necessarily exhaustive, but perhaps you will think of others that you would like to add to your list. The first characteristic of good religion is that your religion is meant to be about how you live your life, not how you demand that others must live theirs. You may legitimately express why, for example, abortion is against your religious beliefs. In that case, don't have one. You may legitimately express why homosexuality is against your religious beliefs. In that case, don't do it. It's become legal. It's not compulsory. Most especially men, don't tell women what they must do with their bodies, how they must contort and deny themselves so that they don't threaten your fear of losing your long-standing patriarchal power and privilege. Good religion is how you develop an intelligent and thoughtful set of beliefs and morals and practices that you then apply to your life, not that you try to impose on others. The second characteristic of good religion, not unrelated to the first, is that it has a strong dose of humility. Let's face it, folks, when it comes to religious belief, none of us really knows what we're talking about. Is there a God? Who knows? It's not a question for objective verification, it is for personal conviction and experience. What kind of God might it be, if there be one? Who knows? I know what attributes and qualities I would want a deity to have to warrant my devotion, but I'm not sure it's up to me to design a God according to my own method of mix and match. What happens after we die, and why is there life on this obscure little planet anyway? Good questions. I wish I knew. In fact, I'm kind of glad I don't know. I would far rather dwell in a world infused with mystery and wonder, not just of hard fact. So given how little we know, would not a little humility in our religious declarations be as wise as they would be welcome? The third characteristic is that good religion leads you to peace, not war, to forgiveness, not lingering resentment, to generosity of heart and spirit, not to meanness, cruelty, and spite. If ever you find yourself using your religion to justify an act of violence against someone else, you can be sure of one thing: your religion is bad religion. Spurn those pulpit peddlers of enmity whose posturing piety would lead a crusade against difference, whose stocks in trade are fear, greed, and mistrust, who base their own power on the denial of power to others. Number four, good religion is a life of action, not passivity. Good religion finds its fruit in the street as much as the sanctuary, the marketplace as much as the mosque, the humdrum as much as the hermitage. Good religion is how you live, not what you profess. It is whom you embrace as your neighbor in the largeness of your heart and the generosity of your actions and the consideration of your words. Good religion is about living life, this life, for its own sake, not as a calculated wager in anticipation of a possible next life. Perhaps there is life after this, perhaps there isn't, who knows? But whatever you believe about that, use those beliefs to be actively kind in this life. And the fifth thing about good religion: do please have a sense of humor about it. Let's face it, as smart as we think we are, as sophisticated and informed and evolved, we are also, every single one of us, just a little bit ridiculous. Take life seriously by all means, but laugh at yourself as well. As Alexander Pope wrote in his essay on man, we are the glory and the jest and the riddle of the world. Enjoy the joke. Good religion is not po-faced, dour, and severe. Good religion knows the joy of life for all of its sufferings and pain. It takes time to admire the sunset. It takes time to linger with a loved one in a moment of tenderness. It takes time to rejoice in the miracle simply of being alive, here, now, with others. So there they are, my five defining characteristics of good religion. It's about how you live, not how you demand others must live. It's humble, recognizing its human limitations of knowledge and insight and experience. It leads to a life of peace, not violence, to love, not hate, to inclusiveness, not division. It leads to a life in which the sacred and the secular are intimately interfused. And it can laugh at itself. It rejoices in this miraculous gift of life. If a religious person has those five characteristics, I care not one fig what name they go by, what festivals they observe, what scriptures they read, or in what building they worship. I care not one fig about the clothes they wear, the food they eat, the language they speak, or the country they call home. I want to call them my brother and my sister, because I want to be part of that universal family of faith. So may it be. Amen.